You know what it means when you hear this song on our show? We were having a little Austin Ekeler withdrawal, and here in the offseason, he was kind enough to check in with his boys to see how things were going. Austin's actually got something really cool coming up, by the way, as well. The Austin Ekeler Foundation's announcing a 2025 charity football fantasy league sign-up. This year, they got a bunch more NFL legends, bunch of players participating, including Geno Smith, A.J. Dillon, Jamal Williams, Brian Dawkins, Ray Lewis. Every participant in Austin's fantasy leagues is going to receive a signed item. They can win prizes including signed gear, game-worn memorabilia, and tickets, championship rings, so much more. See the full list of participants right now at charitydraft.com/NFL-league. But Austin is with us to talk more about this and everything going on in his life this offseason. It has been too long, man. How you been?
What's going on, boys? Got to say, I know you guys have built a great community out there, and I know that because I've been around town a little bit. People are like, hey, I hear you on the Grant and Danny show. And I'm like, man, those guys got it going on. So good work to you guys, but good to see you back.
Yeah, buddy. This is such a cool thing that you're doing. You've always had like great ideas and thoughts about something, and you're always thinking in kind of that 360 panoramic. How did this charity fantasy football thing come about? I think it's such a cool idea.
Yeah, you know, people are passionate about fantasy football, and I'm like, I love that. I love that part of it. And I was like, how can I maybe add to that, but also use it in a way that gives back to the community? And so one year I put up like some game tickets, a game jersey, and a championship ring for people to win. And we had a bunch of people trying to get in. I was like, okay, we might be onto something here. And we've grown ever since then. And so now we do charity fantasy football leagues for kind of like the My Cause, My Cleats of the NFL. Kind of now we do it with fantasy football. So people can, like Ray Lewis has his own foundation that you can go win some signed gear, you know, VIP tickets and stuff like that from his foundation. But then also the money goes to a good cause.
Austin Ekeler, it's the Austin Ekeler Foundation expanding his initiative, including over 20 athletes for the 2025 season in his fantasy football leagues this year for the foundation. His largest annual fundraiser, by the way, they raised more than $80,000 to date, and 100% of that supports the foundation's mission to deliver tangible resources to underserved communities. So job well done by Austin Ekeler. And one of the cool things about you, even before you came to D.C., one of the things that I really was enamored with you for over the years, in addition to the fact that you won me fantasy championships when you were with the Chargers, was how into fantasy football you are and were. And I know that hasn't really changed, but I like that you've parlayed your interest into this as well. You don't hear many guys, they kind of shy away from talking fantasy, that are into it, but it seems like it's still a big part of your football fandom.
Yeah, and I'll give a little story of how I even got into fantasy. It was actually my third year in the NFL. And this is a year where I had, I think, right under 1,000 yards receiving, had like 11 touchdowns, and was pretty just active in the offense. This is like my first year really just being a kind of like a split carry type back. And it was a year where all of a sudden after the season, like I was like the sleeper of the year, because the year before I was mainly like a half special teams guy and then kind of like a backup third string type guy. And so out of nowhere, there's hundreds of people just thank you for winning my fantasy. And I started to realize kind of the magnitude of this fantasy football thing. And I thought it was super cool how people from other teams would be a fan of me because I was on their fantasy team. And I thought that was really special for the league. And I thought that was really cool to see different people from across the world, not even U.S., like I said, across the world, that are like, hey, man, thank you. And so I thought it was really cool. And I love the community aspect that it brings. So again, going back to charitydraft.com, that's exactly what we're trying to do there. There's a lot of guys, like we have, you know, Tyler Biadasz, he's our center, right? He doesn't have probably any really true effect directly on fantasy football, but he has a lot of fans out there from all over the place that probably play fantasy football. So this is an awesome way and another example of how fantasy can bring us together and hopefully can get some good out of fantasy from a fan and athlete standpoint. Because, you know, athletes, we don't really tune into it a lot because a lot of it's a lot of toxicity. So hopefully this is a way to give a better kind of outlook on the fantasy space.
Austin Ekeler with us here on Grant and Danny. Austin, I heard you on the Ross Tucker podcast. I thought you were awesome, engaging, and just, you know, really cool and thoughtful as always. And one of the
questions... Is Austin seeing other radio shows? Is he seeing other broadcasters?
Oh, no.
That's what I was going to ask you about. Ross is a nice guy. I think we like him, but what the hell?
That's our boy.
Yeah, no,
we'll allow that one.
Yeah.
But he's the best.
So I'm just basically ripping this off of him in that conversation you guys had. I thought you gave such a cool answer about his question about closing the gap with Philadelphia. They're the Super Bowl champs. They were really, really good. You guys played them tough multiple times throughout last year. And I thought you gave such a brilliant answer on that. So at the risk of doubling up here, can you rehash that, what you said to Ross, to us, just thinking about how teams are formed and kind of where we're at right now and about, quote, unquote, closing that gap with Philadelphia?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's, from an outside perspective, there's maybe a gap that still exists in football because everyone's like, oh, that's what they did last year. Because as a fan and as analysts, like, it's all about what have you done for me lately? Like, what have you done lately? Well, obviously, Philadelphia had an awesome run and they won the Super Bowl and all of that stuff. Well, now it's a reset. And you could take us, you know, last year, for example, you know, at the beginning of the season, people would have said there was a massive gap between the Washington Commanders and having any chance to make the playoffs because of the season before. But clearly that wasn't the case. We came out, we had a new philosophy, we had new coaches, new culture, new players, and we put something together that was able to, you know, give us a run and push us deep into the playoffs. So it's a new reset. And so when I hear people talk about the gap, I get it because, you know, we got to talk about stuff, people keep people entertained. But for us as players, there is no gap, right? You create the gap, you know, in your offseason training, moving into preseason, into season. It's creating that new gap again. Yes, you have expectations, but that doesn't mean anything when we actually put on the pads and start playing football because things happen. People play better than expected. People play worse than expected. Sometimes there's injuries. So it's all about recreating the gap and reestablishing yourself as a dominant team. And I know we got a lot of players coming back, and I'm looking forward to, you know, continuing to push so we can be hopefully the narrative of, oh, the gap between us and other teams.
Austin, we can get into the Commanders in more detail in a moment, but one of the things I've been wondering for your thoughts on, we just haven't chatted with you in a while, this offseason is, I remember sometime last year talking about the running back position, and you were very opinionated about basically the devaluation of it and how you thought it was going to come back in a big way. And it's pretty amazing that it did, I don't want to say quickly because it's been a few years, but last year, if you look at the number of 1,000-yard backs compared to like 2, 3, 4 years ago, I mean, it skyrocketed. We had two guys flirt with 2,000 yards in Barkley and Derrick Henry carrying their teams deep to the playoffs. We saw Ashton Jeanty, who maybe should have won the Heisman, could have won the Heisman, but, you know, was a top-of-the-board draft pick this year. And it seems like with teams kind of playing two deep safeties, trying to not let teams take the lid off, you know, playing that, like, anti-Chiefs defense that spread throughout the league, the run game became in vogue again with lighter boxes. Curious to get your thoughts on that and how you think that changes kind of the health of the pay scale at the position, because it all changed within the last couple of years.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there are different trends, absolutely, when it comes to philosophies. And, you know, I think there was a few years where we've seen a lot of zero blitz from a few teams, and we still see that from some. Now we're seeing a lot of too high because, all right, as a defense, what do you have to do? You have to make sure that you limit the big plays, because more big plays that you have against you, the more less likely it is for you to score. So if you have a team that has a four-yard drive and a touchdown, that's bad. But if they have a 14-yard drive and a touchdown, you'll take that, because the likelihood of them being able to do that again, 14 yards and a touchdown, is not very high, because eventually someone's going to make a mistake on offense, right? That's what you're banking on. Hey, we're going to be able to bend, not break mentality, at least hold them to a field goal. So I definitely can see a trend of, you know, hey, we're paying a lot of money to these guys to go down the field and make big plays. So let's stop these guys. How do we stop these guys from going down, all these receivers? So guess what? We're going to put some more help back there. So as runners, I mean, you still have to be a dynamic player. Now, I'm not saying everyone can go out there and run for 1,000. It's definitely not easy. But if you're a playmaker, and which we saw a lot of last year, right, you're going to have more opportunities than maybe in the past than you have. And when it comes to the pay, you know, here's what I want to see. If you are an impact player on the team, regardless of position, I think you should see some new money coming into that position. And it had been a while since the running backs were, you know, seeing any new money coming in as far as setting new kind of all-time highs. So I think there was just a lull in our market for a little bit. But again, we were able to kind of establish that, hey, that we have playmakers in our market. And I know Saquon kind of set the new bar. But that's my philosophy when it comes to, you know, the new running kind of opportunities that might be open up with these defenses trying to, hey, exactly like you said, stop the deep ball and make these guys drive all the way down the field play by play.
Austin Eckler with us here on G&D. Austin, you know, going back to last year for you, obviously, you know how we feel here on this radio program. We're Austin Eckler. Guys, you're so good with the ball in your hands. And, you know, you make things easy at times, right? Where just a little, you know, dump off to you is a first down and the chains move and we get a new set. And, you know, so effective, obviously, when you've got the football. What do you want to do this year where you go, you know what, I want to keep doing that? And then looking back at last year, do you go, you know what, I want to do a little bit better in this area? So something you want to keep going with and something you say, you know what, I want to tick that up a little bit.
Yeah, for me, it's always be efficient. And, you know, my role has changed over the years for sure. Now going back to kind of that split back that I used to have in my first 3 years. And so for me at this point, I know with our philosophy, we have Brian Robinson back there who is a big body who, you know, is more of a downhill runner. And so then you have myself who's more, you know, of an elusive type back and catch the ball in the backfield. So there's going to be a complementary type of role in both of us for each other. So for me, it's continue to stay efficient. I actually had like one of my most efficient years last year. I know I missed some games for some concussions, but, you know, I was right there under 5 yards a carry and over 10 yards a carry on the reception. So like that's where I love to be. And I know I'm efficient when I'm at those numbers. And so again, what do I want this year? Want the same. Where do I want to get better? It's some things that we can't always control, which is the injuries. I want to definitely see myself get through the entire season. I know it's a violent, you know, combat sport. So sometimes you just take a hit, you know, and you don't get up from it, unfortunately. And so my thing is continue to make sure that my brain is right, continue that I'm healthy, be available, especially even in the return game. You know, that was something that was asked of me that I haven't done since my rookie year. So I just want to continue to be effective there and just try to make the biggest impact on whatever my role is. Because, you know, we have a competitive backfield right now. We have 8 running backs in the room. So, you know, looking at last year, we played a lot of guys. There was a lot of guys that rotated. I think we played like 4 or 5 running backs last year. And so I know that's probably going to be something that is going to happen again this year, depending on the situations and things like that. But again, whatever my role is, continue to stay the most efficient I possibly can, which is just building off what I did last year.
Yeah, your efficiency was essentially back to your year three area, right around 23, 24 years old, averaging about 5 yards per attempt. And as you said, 10.5 per catch. And people forget you ripped off the first return of the season in the home opener. Got called back for a penalty, but some huge plays on special teams as well. I don't always like asking guys to speak for other players, but just because you're around him and you've kind of seen his demeanor, you know, so much of this offseason around here, and I'll raise my hand, I guess I'm part of the problem. You know, a lot of us were longing for maybe someone to pair with you at the running back position that might be able to provide a little bit more of a home run ability or speed to go with you. And it's not that anybody's down on B-Rob, but I think he's taking it that way. And some social media stuff about how hard he's working and he hears the noise and whatnot. Just your thoughts on him going into the season. It's a big year for him personally, obviously for the team. They need him to shine. And just his demeanor as you've seen him this offseason getting to work.
Yeah, absolutely. My man is definitely fired up, as fired up as he can possibly be. He's got a big year for him. We've talked about it. He knows this, not only because, you know, it's the year that he's in, but because it's contract year. Like as NFL players, we already have the utmost pressure on us. And a lot of that is put on by ourselves because we have a standard for ourselves that we want to play to the highest and not just compete, but win, right? And so when you have that type of mentality, you know, you have to deal with that because there's the pressure of the media of maybe, hey, maybe you're not playing or where you want to be. But my man right now is juiced, jacked up, healthy, ready to go. So I'm excited for B-Rob to have a big year.
Can you go into the expectations that kind of come on with the season you guys had last year? I know you were there in L.A. for a while when, you know, you guys started to get pretty good. You know, I think you got a 12-win season in the mix while you were there. And all of a sudden, the expectations become, hey, this is now one of the elite teams in the NFL, and kind of dealing with that. Maybe the target on your back, that to use a terrible cliche that everyone always talks about. But what's it going to be like to deal with some of the expectations you guys have this year after that unbelievable year last year?
Yeah, you know, I think when you look at this year coming up, I think one thing that's really going to help us is Dan Quinn's philosophies. DQ does not let us look past one day. We will come into the team meeting and he'll say, hey, I got Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. I got all that scheduled out. Trust me, that day will come. I need you right here on Monday. like, this is where I need you right here, right now. And he is all about in the moment, the brotherhood at the time, the energy that we need at that moment. If it's a practice, if it's a walkthrough, we need the walkthrough type energy. If it's game day, hey, we got to be in the game day, you know, type, you know, energy. So for him, he's always making sure that he keeps the team where we should be. And that helps us manage our expectations, because our expectations are to continue to be the best that we can in that moment for what that moment is. And so for us, you know, there wasn't a lot of expectation from the outside noise. Now there is. But for us, it's no different, because we're not looking outside. We're looking at one day at a time. And I really appreciate Dan Quinn and how much he really preaches that to us, because it's definitely going to help us, because I know there's definitely going to be a lot of noise about, hey, what we're supposed to do, what we're supposed to be. But for us, none of that matters, because we got to take it day to day to even get to some of these expectations that people are expecting from us.
Austin Ekeler, again, the new venture he's got, and he's ramping it up this year, is the Ekeler Foundation 2025 Charity Fantasy Football Leagues. They've got more NFL players and more NFL legends than ever before partaking. There's all kinds of great things that you can win, so you'll want to check that out at Austin's website and at the Austin Ekeler Foundation's site. Last one for me. I'm taking on some heat for this today, no pun intended, but I want to see where you come in. I don't want to lead the witness. The four seasons ranked by Austin Ekeler, 1-4, favorite to least favorite, your ranking of the seasons would be what?
Of just like summer, winter, fall seasons or what?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, sorry. Yeah, not sports. Yeah. Fall, spring, winter, summer.
We got to want to switch up there, man. You got to like set me up a little bit. You know, we're talking four seasons, the hotel. We're talking four seasons, you know.
We don't get to stay in those,
you know,
as often. No,
the
Motown
band, right? Okay. The four seasons, yeah.
My long time take has been that summer's the worst season. It's probably because I'm a bigger fella. I think it's terrible and overrated. So I've got fall, spring, winter, summer in that order. What is your ranking of seasons?
Okay. Ranking of seasons. I'm going to say spring. I love spring as number one, because it's kind of cooler. Things are growing. You know, you're just coming out of winter, and it's like, all right, like this is kind of like the new fresh start. Fall is probably number two, because that's when, you know, for the past 21 years of my life, I have strapped it up and played football, not missed a season, knock on wood. So that's number two. I'll say summer is number three. A lot of some good times in the summer, kind of like a reset type of time. And then I hate the cold. That's why I live on the West Coast. So I'll say winter is last.
Wow. Mm. Yeah, Danny, I think it's just that, you know, we don't like being outside and sweating. That's got to be what it
is. Yeah, but in shape guys, like, oh, my shirt fell off again. Look at all my abs. Like, I get that, Austin. I get that from you.
Yeah. That's what I'm doing. Right. Hey, but I said spring. Summer's third for me, so it's not too far off.
I love spring. Pretty good.
Also wanted to just throw this in there, because I know maybe it got messed up in the brief. But, yeah, it's charitydraft.com is where you can see all of our stuff that we're doing this year with all the fantasy leagues. So if you want to win some awesome prizes, like for example, if you make it to the playoffs in one of my tiers, you get tickets to Commanders Eagles, right? So home game week 15. So definitely check it out, charitydraft.com. Go see what's going on over there. See all the awesome prizes and all the causes that are being affected by all this.
So cool. Awesome. Great to catch up with you, man. Stay healthy.
Likewise.
We'll talk to you soon, buddy. Thank you.
Sounds good. Yep. See you guys.
See you, bud.
There's our guy, Austin Ekeler. You heard him all season long on Grant and Danny. You see why we love having him on The Fan.
We don't die.
B. Mitchell Finley, yes, 1067, The Fan. This is really, really cool. B got a copy of this book. If you're looking on the stream, I'll show it to you. I'm also going to tweet this out. This book is called RFK All Access, and it's a book of photos compiled from RFK Stadium during the golden era of the Washington Redskins, when RFK bumped and the team won Super Bowls. Scott Cunningham is the author and the photographer. Scott, what's up, man? This book is incredible.
Hey, thanks, JP. There's a great way to show how much fun that era was to me. I have all these pictures. I've never had a chance to do anything. I've had other books and other sports, but this is probably the greatest thing that I ever have done and will do, just because of the love for the Redskins. And I've got the follow-up coming in color in a few months, but the black and white was just from a certain time frame. The color is going to cover the whole that whole era, but I can't wait to see what kind of reaction that gets, because it was all it's an art book too.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily a photography, but it's about process. You know, taking your own film, processing your own film, scanning it yourself, and then putting it on a computer and laying it out was probably, I think I have to go into rehab. It was so much fun.
Well, Scott, I tell you this, man. I was looking through it last night, and I texted him on the text thread we have for the show. And I was like, man, I was looking through this book, and I can remember exact moments of those pictures. And, you know, sometimes you can relive the conversations you were having when certain things happen. So I appreciate it, man. I thank you for putting that together.
Oh, you're welcome, Brian. It was a pleasure to watch the Swiss Army Knife. Let me just tell you, this guy needs to be in the Hall of Fame. We know it's not. It's the time is it may have passed. I don't know what those rules are.
2028 Veterans Committee.
2028. Okay. Well, I'll get on the phone here in a little while.
Yeah, dude.
But anyway, no, that was such a great period of time. That era, I don't know, 82 to 92. I think this group can match it, though. I think this group, you know, especially off what you're coming off of last year. I think Washington football's back. It's great. You know, there's nothing better than that place when it was shaken. And maybe the new stadium they'll put in there and put some loose seats so we can get it shaken again.
Let's hope so.
When you were putting this book on, and you start hearing all the information that the team possibly moving back to D.C., RFK coming back, you know, how did that make you feel?
I loved it. Loved it. I know I blast Sean up at the commander's PR department. I said, man, you got to go back to the hole. You got to go back in that hole. He got tired of hearing me say it. But I just was like, that is just the only place for that stadium to be.
Yeah.
You know,
let's hope, and
I can't wait to see what they do around it.
Yeah,
because that area, I don't know where they're going to put it. You know, out in the river somewhere, but it's going to be awesome. I can't imagine that view that they used to show of RFK when you'd have all the statues in line and at night game, and you can see the stadium lit up. I can't wait to see what this stadium's going to look like lit up like that. That is it's going to be a proud moment for us Blue Bloods.
Talking to Scott Cunningham, author of a new book called RFK All Access. I mean, this has got to be, what, 500-600 pages of photos?
It's 392 pages, and there's about 500 pictures in there, and they're all, I would say 99% are from black and white. I had to fill in some color negative shots to tell a story, but a certain story, but I like the layout just because you don't have to. I didn't have to say anything. I just let the pictures do the talking.
Oh yeah.
I start out from Jack Kent Cook down through the coaches, and then lead into each individual player. Actually, I went into.
Hey, I'm holding up various pictures for all the people watching on the stream. Russ Grimm, after a game, wearing he's in his game pads, but his. Everybody always wears a shirt under their shoulder pads and says, I'm having a Malox moment.
Well, the game, the cold game, I think Ernest had, 39 carries, 140-something yards. I was looking at it, and Chris said, man, I was at that game, 1990, November 1990, something like December. Yeah.
That was the worst game, weather game I've ever been around.
Doc as a reporter.
Joe Howard Johnson, that's who we're interviewing.
Scott, there's so many incredible moments, right? Are there certain photos that stand out to you the most?
A lot of them, yeah. I don't know. That's a good question. Now that I think of it, I don't know. I don't know. I get a kick out of the ones with the posse. Those guys always gave me good pictures.
Yeah. When is the book coming out for the public consumption?
I would say in about a week. It's available now on the website, www.rfkallaccess.com.
Very cool, man. The picture.
And it'll be in stores soon. Working on a network. I hope that Carter Machinery, a new sponsor, will get involved. They're a great company. My dad was involved with them back all the way to the 50s. So
wow.
I'm hoping that Carter Machinery gets some good publicity out of that because my father was one of the founders of that company, and I'm really proud of it.
All right.
This is so cool. I mean, there's pictures in here of Darryl Green making serious tackles. Everybody always thinks of the speed, but he was.
Yeah, he was a headhunter, wasn't he?
He does look like George. He's coming in high on all these hits. Look.
Yeah.
George Atkinson stuff. You know, I never thought of him like George Atkinson, but I guess he is.
Yep. Oh, yeah. D Green.
Look at this. D Green with George Bush Sr. at the White House. You were there too.
Darryl got a hot dog fade.
Yeah, sure does.
Did you go to the White House, Brian?
Yeah. After we won the Super Bowl, yes.
What did they serve you?
Well, I know what they served Bush.
I can't remember what we had.
It was beer. Do you remember him throwing horseshoes?
He was good at horseshoes,
I went with,
right?
Reagan. No,
it was Bush.
That was Bush. That was Bush. Yeah. It was Ricky.
Bush and Art Monk and Ricky were playing, and I think Bush got a little tipsy that day.
I like it.
We had a good time.
I like him now.
I'm telling you.
All right, so the website is rfkallaccess.com. A ton of photos from Scott Cunningham from a decade of being inside the locker room as the Skins went to 4 Super Bowls in 9 years. What an incredible run. Scott, thank you for the time, bro. Really appreciate it,
Scott.
Thank you. I can't wait to see the Washington football come back and make us forget this last bunch of crap we had to put up with.
Hey, whole you new too, world, everybody.
Thank you, Scott.
All right, man. Appreciate you.
Guys. Thank you. Appreciate it.
This book is incredible, dude. I see why you're so into it.
Oh, yeah.
All right, I'm going to tweet this out so folks can find it. I'll put it on Facebook, too. Nobody go anywhere. We're just getting warmed up. It's B. Mitchell Finley.
Fast-moving stuff this week as it relates to the RFK deal. Remember back in late April, the mayor and Josh Harris, along with a lot of dignitaries, announced that the team was headed back home to the RFK site. A deal had been struck, but there, of course, was always the need for this deal to be passed by the D.C. City Council. That hasn't happened yet. The original deal called for a July 15th deadline for the council to vote on it. And yesterday, the chair, Phil Mendelson, introduced legislation to separate the stadium deal from the budget itself, which means it won't get voted on by July 15th. So lots of stuff happening. The team responded. Let's go to our guy, Eric Flack from Channel 9. We bring him on to the show. Of course, Eric does a great job covering a lot of different things for WUSA Channel 9. But a lot of the investigative stuff for all those years with Snyder and now the stadium stuff, he's been all over at Eric Flack TV on X and on Twitter. So you were on my podcast yesterday, and then more stuff happened after we recorded that. So catch everybody up to speed, you know, from April 28th to where we are now.
Yeah, well, you know, the big issue that I think your listeners need to know about is the fact that the mayor had made the RFK Stadium funding deal a part of the larger budget. And from the beginning, which means the money was all tied up as part of this larger overall budget plan. And there was a lot of criticism from DC Council about when the stadium deal was introduced and announced in relation to when the budget itself was handed to DC Council. And from the beginning, there has been pushback from DC Council about not being able to fully digest it and being painted into a corner by the mayor to approve the deal without proper oversight. And so despite assurances in the past that they would not do that, yesterday DC Council voted to strip the RFK Stadium deal out of the city's budget cycle this year. Now, that does not mean that they're not going to approve it, pass it, or ultimately bring the Commanders back to the RFK site. What it does mean is that they are dealing with one of the more complicated and consequential budgets in recent D.C. history because of the deficit and everything that's going on with the federal government. And they are literally kind of focused to a man and woman on the budget issues facing the city outside of the stadium. And they have pulled the stadium issue out of the budget to settle the budget itself, police officers, education, violence interrupters, that sort of thing. And then they're going to consider the stadium as part of a separate legislation now, once they will get to after they settle the budget sometime this month. The problem, in the eyes of the Washington Commanders, is that this now threatens their timeline to open the stadium in 2030 and bid on things like having D.C. and the new stadium be a Women's World Cup site in 2031, because they say every month that D.C. Council does not approve this stadium pushes back their timeline and threatens everything that they have laid out. So things have gone from tense to more tense between D.C. Council, who feels like they are being bullied by the mayor and the team, and the mayor, Mayor Bowser, and the Commanders, who feel like they are giving D.C. Council a gift of a financial windfall and economic redevelopment that the city desperately needs right now.
All right, so what we are now dealing with is not whether or not they will get to it and will vote on it, but the time frame in which they get to it and whether or not that pleases or displeases the football team. And based on their statement, even though, you know, it was somewhat upbeat, the fact that, you know, it ends with, "We are hopeful the council will continue to work in an expedited way to approve this deal and deliver a significant win for the people of D.C., I think, you know, reflects the frustration over sort of what I think many people would perceive, and I know that there's a lot of complexity to this, but the perception is, hey, you got this on April 28th. Yeah, you got the budget, you got the stadium. Do both of them within the time frame of July 15th. So let's get to it. When will they vote on it? When will, if it's not July 15th, when will it be, and how much will that impact the team, and what would the team do as a response if it didn't get voted on until well after the deadline?
I think a lot of this, we're now in uncharted territory, but really this stadium issue has actually been pretty calm sailing until now. I think what I'm being told is that certainly August, before D.C. Council would be able to approve a stadium deal, possibly September. And when you start talking about possibly September, that's when the team starts getting really, really upset. They're issuing statements saying, you know, we any substantive delays, the words that they're using in their official statement are any substantive.
Yeah, that's the word. Is substantive.
Delays.
Yeah.
Any serious delays. Let's dumb it down for people like me. any serious delays to approval are going to threaten specifically them bidding on the 2030 being a host site for 2031 World Cup. So my understanding from people close to this is that's September. If it goes past August, I've been told August is kind of the drop dead. What date in August? I'm not sure. But sometime in August, if you get past that, then the team starts saying their timeline is really kind of messed up. I have been told by at least one or two council members that this drifting into September is very much a possibility. The council members tell me, quite honestly, look, A, we don't want to screw this up. We don't want to mess up the Commanders. And there's an idea that if the city is in fact going to spend this much money, that you better do it in a way where you're going to get all the benefits. And
right,
certainly being a Women's World Cup,
that's a benefit to the city as much as it is to the owners of the football team.
So if you're going to spend the money, and do it in a timeline which is ultimately going to bring you immediate returns. And so, but the question then becomes, I think on a lot of council members' minds, wait, are they really not going to be able to bid on the Women's World Cup if we approve this in September as opposed to August? Is that really, really going to, like, be the difference? And I think that's where kind of the gray area comes in, is that you've got the team saying, look, we've already condensed the timeline. We're already trying to do this in basically under 5 years, or just about 5 years, if you're talking about from now. But, I mean, shovels aren't even in the ground yet. And so every month or two of delays, and then you get into December, the winter months where you probably can't work as much. Every month or two of delays over the summer actually, you know, is compounded, or is it this kind of just more, you know, jockeying by the team with the DC Council trying to get their deal passed? And I think that's where kind of the gray area now comes in, is who's right, who's wrong, and how consequential is a month or two more of delays.
Yeah, you and I talked about this yesterday, but, you know, the council does have a job to do. I think most reasonable people understand that, and if you're a tax-paying D.C. resident, and I am, you want the best possible deal for the city, and it's their job to get that. And perhaps by waiting and pushing it off and having a deep understanding that they don't want to go anywhere, they're not going to Maryland, and they're not going to lose the 2031 FIFA Women's World Cup, maybe they end up getting a better deal and they look really good at the end. But the perception right now is bureaucratic snail's pace. How about do two things simultaneously? How about work, you know, 24/7 and over weekends and get this thing done and let's move on? And I'm not saying they're not. I'm just saying the perception can be left that that's what's going on.
And then they would be on this call with you right now, Kevin, and they would say, well, if the timing were so important, you know, why didn't the mayor and the, you know, loop in the council sooner? You know, why? And so my point being that there's all this finger pointing, like, well, you should have done this. Well, you should have done this. And in the end, you know, we're kind of left with two sides who want to get to the same destination, but are kind of arguing because of politics, maybe because of egos and because of true, like, you know, altruistic responsibility to serve their constituents somewhere in there. You hope that it's in there as to like how it's going to be done and how quickly it's going to be done. And then you get to the question of what are the council really going to ask for, and are the commanders really going to be able to like accommodate that, and who's going to ultimately, you know, it becomes a game of chicken, and who's going to ultimately back down and acquiesce, and are we going to start digging our heels in, and, you know, how much hardball are either side going to play? How much hardball can either side play at this point?
Well, post July 15th, based on the term sheet and my understanding of it, the only way chicken is played is if the team goes back to Maryland and starts to negotiate.
That's what I'm saying. Like, you know, let's say the council asks for something. Let's say it goes to August. And the council is like, well, we want more revenue on the parking. We want part of the parking revenue. Because right now we don't get any of the parking revenue. We pay for parking garages, but we don't keep any of the money. That's a big sticking point. And the team is like, go pound sand. We're keeping the parking revenue. Well, where do we go from there? Like, you know, but the council's like, no, we want the parking revenue. And the team's like, we're not giving you the parking revenue. We need that to pay for the stadium. Well, who gives in that situation? You know, it's things like that, and there's a million little...
Do you think that's the number one sticking point, parking revenue?
I think that the labor thing, which is really inside baseball, it's really
what, union versus non-union?
The union stuff, the idea that the mayor has stripped a provision, like if it's government or federal land, you're supposed to use... like this PLA, like I forget what PLA, performance labor agreement, but you're supposed to basically use like union folks on like any development on like federal land. And the mayor stripped that or tweaked it to say yes for the stadium, but for everything else that's going to be built a lot by Josh Harris and investors and like him, this doesn't apply. Well, that angers the council, too. And they are like, wait, that's not fair to workers, union workers who are going to lose out on all these other projects. I mean, that's another one. I mean, Council Member White told me he wants the Commanders to move their headquarters to D.C. Well, that as part of this deal, that's not going to happen, you know. But what if he digs his heels in? He's like, I want you to move your headquarters to D.C. so we get the full benefit of the Washington Commanders. Well, the Commanders are all set up in Ashburn, and they're investing hundreds of millions of dollars. You know,
they could move some of their stuff in College Park to D.C., though, right?
What are headquarters, right?
I mean, but we're talking about a minimal number of employees, I think.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So it's stuff like that.
All right. I know you got a role, but the exit question is two part. One, give me a prediction on when they vote on this. And two, where is the city council right now, the 12 members of the city council on yes, no votes?
So that's such a, okay. First question first. I think cooler heads prevail and they get this done in August, because I think D.C. Council does ultimately realize that speeding up this process benefits them financially in the long run. And I think the 2031 Women's World Cup is a big deal. That is not too far away. Those are dollar returns that they can see and say, okay, reach out and touch. And because we're not talking about something too far down the road, and I think it's embarrassing that D.C. is not a site for the Men's World Cup, and right. and they don't want that to happen again. So I'll say August with that. B, the Post has this count. Okay, I mean, people like White, you know, there are some, like, you know, there are the yes votes with just the McDuffies, the Pintos of the world, like Danita Bonds, they're like, yes, whatever. They're in the no votes, like Nadeau. See, I only count Nadeau as no, definitely no vote, maybe Allen. But I don't count Mendelsohn as a no vote. I think ultimately he is going to, and I think White and a lot of the others that say there are conditions and we're not sure, I think they're ultimately going to come around. I told you yesterday, even Robert White, who I did this interview with, who has major concerns, he's bringing up all these problems, acknowledges, and he gives the analogy of the Louis Vuitton shoes. He's like, my wife, you know, may want Louis Vuitton shoes. That might not be a great financial decision for me and my family, but she wants it, and the kids think she's going to love them and look good in them. And eventually I buy the Louis Vuitton shoes, even though, like, I don't think it's really the best use of our money, because it's just kind of what we want to do. And he says the stadium kind of ultimately becomes that. Like, are there financial concerns? Sure. But, like, you know, it is pretty clear a lot of the people want it. And we just might have to kind of, like, take our time with, like, how we agree to this, to spending all this money. And I think all those people in that camp ultimately come and find a way to vote for the stadium.
By the way, and I got to run and you got to run, and I'm up against a hard break, but would they even vote if they didn't have seven votes?
I mean, they can. Anybody can call for a vote at any time.
Okay.
I mean, it's not up to the Commanders or the mayor. This is out of their hands at this point. It's in the hands of the D.C. Council.
All right. Hope you're right. Hope they get it done, you know, in August, and that's satisfactory to the team. Appreciate it, as always, Eric. Thanks. Great job. Eric Flack, everybody. Investigative, Murrow Award-winning investigative reporter.
Welcome back. Junkies come to you live on 106.7 The Fan and the Team 980. If you missed any part of the show, we have the Wizards GM, Will Dawkins, on earlier. Of course, you can grab the podcast wherever you download your podcast. Just search Sports Junkies. All right, join us right now on the Rude Guest Hotline. Rude's most reliable heating and air conditioning products in the DMV. He's minority owner of the Commanders, and he's the chairman of the Mubadala City DC Open. It's our pal Mark Ein. What's going on, Mark?
Hey, guys. Great to be with you this morning.
Dude, your field just keeps getting better here for the DC Open coming up here in late July. Tell us about all the top players. I think you got seven top 10 players, but if you expand it to like the world's top 14, you just had a slew of them.
Yeah, it's unreal. We're so thrilled about this. As you said, we got seven of the world's top 10. We have the top nine American men. And then that doesn't even include like Grand Slam champions like Naomi Osaka and Emma Raducanu, who are coming, and then people like Nick Kyrgios and Gael Monfils and Kei Nishikori. So like the players that That's everyone amazing. Loves to come out and see. Yeah, yeah, it's
I thought
unreal.
Kyrgios was done. I'm just way behind the curve.
I literally was messaging him yesterday about coming to D.C. He loves this tournament. I mean, he played a bit earlier this year. I saw him play in Indian Wells. He was great. He just keeps getting injured. He's got a lot of things that, you know, he's interested in. He's actually building his life outside of tennis. But when he's on the court, he's still unbelievable. And, you know, he's won our tournament twice. So so it's a place that he just loves to come to, and he's fully planning to be here.
What's the payout for the winner of the men's side?
$550,000, I think.
Okay.
Not bad.
It's good money.
Yeah.
It's good money, and it's a lot of ranking points. You know, this tournament on both sides, like, there's a long history of players who come here, and it kind of, like, Medvedev in 19 made a finals. Like, no one even had heard of him when he finaled and lost to Nick in 19, and he went on to final the U.S. Open that year and ultimately became number one in the world. Paula Badosa last year, we gave her a wild card. She was like 70 in the world, and then she's now back up in the top 10. So it's a lot of points, it's a lot of money, and it's a good springboard for people.
Has Djokovic ever played in it?
You know, it's funny. I see him around. I don't know that he is. Roger actually did once when he was really young, and obviously Rafa came.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. Novak, every time I see him, he says, I'm going to come to Washington one of these days.
Right,
it'd be great if we could make that happen.
I have to tell you, Mark, that I think most of us here on this show, we all kind of grew up playing tennis. And, you know, I know I've told you before that some of us, I know Cakes and I, we were like ball boys. I don't even know if you were. You probably did that at one point.
I was.
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah. It was such a great, I have just such fond memories of tennis, professional tennis here in D.C., and just like,
didn't you get yelled at by some player?
Yeah, of course. I mean, Michael Pernfors sent me up.
I did.
Who'd you get yelled at by, Mark?
Oh, I think John McEnroe wasn't paying attention. I'd give him the ball quick enough or something like that.
There's always something. I remember Michael Pernfors sent me on a Perrier run.
Michael Pernfors.
You know, like in the middle of his match.
Pernfors. Was he German?
I don't know. He was something.
No, he was Swedish.
Swedish. Okay.
He went to Georgia.
Yeah, that's right.
I remember I ball boyed for Slobodan Zivanovic.
I definitely remember him.
Jay Berger. I mean, I just have just
no,
such
but
fond
wasn't
memories.
Like Harold Solomon and Eddie Dibbs were our heroes. It was like, and then Connors and Vilas, and it's amazing. Yeah, I remember it was on clay, and literally like the stands were just bleachers. And,
yes.
I mean, honestly, that's my life experience too, and that's where my passion for this comes, is like we had those memories. The tournament was going to likely leave D.C. when we stepped in 19. Like, the organization that owned it forever couldn't make the investments that were needed. And it wasn't the easiest thing to get done, but I was like, there's no way, if there's any way I can stop this from leaving, that it can leave, because there's so many people like us who this is such an important part of their lives, and I want it to be here forever. So,
well, so Mark's the chairman of the Mubadala City D.C. Open. You told us this last time, beyond the great tennis, and you've got seven top 10 stars competing July 19th through 27th, you guys have great food set up, right?
Well, that's a big part of what we wanted to do when we took it over. So we took it over. It's a big, important tennis event, but the fan experience just really wasn't good. Literally, the people that served the park service food the rest of the year were serving the food. There was nowhere indoor or air conditioned to go if you weren't a VIP. And so we had this real vision that came a little bit from our World Team Tennis days of creating this incredible fan experience. And so, yeah, we've built these unbelievable big indoor air conditioned food hall with a big bar and big TV screens. We have a taco tequila bar, a rosé terrace overlooking the courts. And then we have like the best of DC. We have Duke's Grocery burgers. We have Dolcezza. We have King Street Oysters. So it's like the best of DC food. Last year, I think we had 5 Michelin star chefs. This year, we have 7. So also at the high end. And so the whole idea behind that is that, you know, a day at a tennis match isn't just going to 1-2 hour match. If it's good food, good drinks, good places to hang out, people will come for 5, 6, 7 hours, and then they'll stay. And then they'll come back a bunch during the week. So when we took this over, less than 20% of the tickets were season tickets, you know, people who bought or tournament, full tournament, and then people just come for one day. Now it's over 70% people are buying tickets for the whole week.
Wow.
And I think a lot of it is due to, it's obviously the quality of the play is incredible, but also the quality of the experience off the court.
I do, again, I just have such fond memories, even, you know, in adulthood, into adulthood, just going there and just watching guys hit on the practice courts.
Mm-hmm. Like, exactly.
And then watching the women. I mean, it's just unbelievable. It's just, I can't recommend it enough.
I appreciate saying that. You know, it's one of only 10 tournaments in the world that have men and women playing at the same event. It's like, it's hard to believe because it seems, because people watch the Grand Slams, which are.
Right.
But there's a 4 Grand Slams, 5 other tournaments, and us. And
we have, like, Indian Wells. Did they still have Lipton? Like, those were ones that used to be.
Yeah, what are
Indian Wells, Miami, Cincinnati, Madrid, and Rome, and then us.
Wow.
It's very cool.
That is crazy.
Very
so,
cool.
So, going to transition here. You know, you talked about how you've changed the experience for the DC Open and making it beyond just the tennis, that people are excited about the food. I think that's your vision with RFK. Can you kind of fill us in on what's happening? I know the Commanders released a statement. We talked about it. I get it. There's a government process, but you can at least talk about what you see for RFK in the community.
Yeah, look, I think the team's made an amazing case for why this makes a ton of sense. You know, you can look at it from so many different dimensions, but, like, first of all, in D.C., there have been 3 stadiums built, and every single one has transformed the area it was in. If you guys, when I moved back to D.C. in the 90s, I lived down the street from where Cap One Arena was. Mm-hmm. That literally, a block away was a red light district. Mm-hmm. You know, the East End was forgotten. No one came over. You build Cap One, that part of town's completely transformed. Then you do the baseball stadium. Mm-hmm. You go drive down there. It's actually incredible. I don't ever go down there, and it blows my mind how an old industrial area is now literally just building after building after building. And then you go to the soccer stadium, where I actually own the land under the soccer stadium. It was a junkyard and an old warehouse. And there was a coal-fired Pepco power plant there that was never going to move until the land was needed. You build a soccer stadium, it gets transformed. So, like, we have these case studies of what happens. And then you have 180 acres on that part of town where it hasn't gotten the same investment. And here's the perfect catalyst to do exactly the same thing, but actually even bigger. So that's one lens. And then the other thing I'd say is, you know, I've lived the journey here. I was on the board to bring the Olympics here. I was co-chair of the group to try to bring the 2026 World Cup to D.C. And that was so frustrating because FIFA badly wanted to have games in D.C. next year. Mm-hmm. It's very unusual for a capital city not to get games, but we didn't have a stadium. They made us bid for the World Cup with the Baltimore Stadium. And what people may forget is that the National Fan Festival for the World Cup was going to be on the National Mall. We were going to have 3 of the biggest teams staying in D.C. All that's gone. And, yeah, that's nice because you get to go to games, but the economic impact of stuff like that is so massive, you know. And then you listen at the press conference, Roger talked about that, you know, he had no promises, but certainly you're going to be considered for Super Bowls. The economic impact in New Orleans was $1.2 billion for the Super Bowl. So, like, these things are economic drivers.
Is
and
there
I
a hard
think...
deadline, Mark? Because, you know, it's kind of hard for us to, like, figure it all out. We hear the Mendelsohn say something. We hear you guys say something. Is there a deadline for you guys to be able to make, you know, 2030, which I guess was the goal all along.
Yeah,
for you guys,
I mean,
get
that's,
to
and again, you know, just back to events, obviously the 2031 Women's World Cup's here, so I think everyone wants to make it happen. I don't want to get into that stuff. I do legitimately believe everyone is working towards getting this done and getting it done so it can open in 2030, and that's what we're certainly hoping is going to happen.
So you're not, at this point, you're not sweating it.
I honestly think that the right thing's going to happen. I think it's pretty clear, and I also think if you listen to people aren't saying they're against it. They just want to make sure that we run a good process. I really believe it's going
to
happen.
Right, which makes sense.
So the D.C. Open, back to the D.C. Open, it's July 19th through the 27th.
Mm-hmm.
You can get ticket packages. You can go to SeatGeek.com or you can go to tickets at MDETennis.com or MubadalaCityOpen.com. There's a bunch of ways to get it.
What about for the junks? How do the junks get tickets?
They just call their buddy Mark.
Yeah. And they're waiting at will call. They're at will call.
That's what I'm talking about.
We'd love to. Like, I will say, and I don't come on and, like, try to, you know, talk about tickets, but we are almost the last, every ticket we've sold out in the last 4.5 years, and we're down to, like, less than 10% of the tickets. It'll probably sell out in a week or two. And so I definitely hope people come out. I love the fact that our tennis community comes out, but also when people come who haven't seen tennis live and they see it up close, and as you said, like even just going to the practice court and seeing it that close, yeah, you really get an appreciation for it. So whether you like tennis, great food, great drinks,
all
a good time.
Dude,
in the
just
summer.
Go watch the women hit.
Yeah,
it's mind blowing. It's mind
blowing. Exactly. Watch my girl Rybakina hit. She's unbelievable.
She's coming. Yeah. She's
I know
coming.
She is.
I got, she's coming.
She's great.
Yeah.
All right, Mark. Always
Mark,
fun talking
thank you.
To you. Thank you,
guys,
Mark.
Appreciate it.
All right,
thank
it's Mark Ein, Commander's minority owner and chairman of the Mubadala
We're
City
buddies with
DC
the
Open.
Big Sillies. We're just buddies with Big Sillies.
We got a lot of questions we want to get to the bottom of with the ongoing discussion between the city council and the Commanders on the stadium, RFK 2.0. So we got our guy on, Charles Allen, D.C. council member, who's been on the show many times now and is always very candid with us. And we don't always have to see eye to eye, but at the end of this thing, I think we high-five and go our separate ways. Is it okay if we call you our guy now, Charles? Can we do that?
Absolutely. Good afternoon, guys.
Good afternoon to you as well. So can you answer my main question that I kept asking yesterday, which is, was I lied to or not? Okay. Mendelsohn said that there's a quote from him where he said that they're not going to be taking the funding out of the budget. And then the DC Examiner report came out and said that they're trying to take the stadium out of the budget. Is this semantics where he's saying it's still in the budget but being set aside, or did he change his mind?
I'm never going to try to speak for another council member, but here's what I know has happened. So when the mayor sent the budget down to us, that's when she put the RFK Stadium deal enmeshed and embedded within that. What I understand the chairman to be doing is essentially drawing a circle around the money that would be involved in a stadium deal, putting that off to the side, and then the legislative language so that we can deal with the stadium as a standalone piece of legislation. So the funding is all still there and kind of a circle drawn around it so nobody can kind of go touch it for the moment. And then we deal with the legislation as a standalone. So that's what I understand to be happening. And that allows us, frankly, to have the time. I mean, when the ballpark, now the ballpark was in front of us, the council spent 11 months examining that and ultimately voting on it. When Audi Field was in front of us, that was 6 or 7 months and then ultimately to vote. I think we're on a much faster timeline than that actually here, but we were hired to do a job. And so we're not going to rush our way through it. We got to make sure we spend the time to examine this. And it's not a good deal that's in front of us. And so there's a lot of us that say, if it's going to happen, it's got to get a lot better.
So what is the bigger issue then? Because the last part you say is not a good deal. That's debatable. And that is continuing to be debated by a lot of people. But the other part is we need more time. We don't have enough time. So what is the issue? That the deal's not good or that you need more time?
Well, both. I mean, I don't know the last time you spent over $1 billion, but you probably didn't do it in just a couple of weeks. So you got to spend a little time being able to look at it. We have a independent economic analysis that's taking place. It'll come back in the next couple of weeks. We've got tons of questions that have gone out that we don't have answers to. Spend it a few weeks, spend it a few months to make sure you get it right for when you're talking about over $1 billion. I mean, this is the second largest public subsidy for a stadium in American history. You got to get that right. So we're going to take our time and make sure we do that.
Councilmember Charles Allen with us here on Grant and Danny. So what are some of those questions, Councilmember, that you say haven't been answered yet that you're looking for answers to?
Oh, great question. So right now, you know, we're trying to figure out, so how is this thing financed? So right now, let's take a look at the parking. I've been very critical of 8,000 parking spaces. That's way too much. But right now, the deal is structured that not only does DC taxpayers build all these massive parking lots that'll sit empty most of the time, but all the parking revenue goes to the team. They don't pay any taxes on it. That's not even how we deal with the other parking lots. So have they built the financing that they're putting in based off of just taking all your parking money and skipping over the tax dollars? What are some of the fundamentals and financials around this deal? Those are the types of questions you got to ask. How are you going to move 65,000 people here? I've got a whole series of questions to our metro system with the commander saying, help me understand how you're going to move people in and out of here. Those are questions that your legislative body, your elected leaders have got to get answers to. So there's a ton of things we're still trying to make sure we understand.
How many parking spots for you wouldn't be too many? Because you say 8,000 is too many, and it's already a sticking point with fans and probably with the team as not being ideal and not being enough.
Well, I disagree. I mean, there's no way you need 8,000 parking spaces. You've got Metro, for example. You got Stadium Armory right there. We've been talking about it for 20 years about building a new Metro station there at Oklahoma and Binning. You've got a 42,000-seat stadium at Nats Ballpark with 1,200 parking spaces, and that works pretty well because you got Metro a block away.
But you know there's no tailgating culture with baseball.
Remember, this is giving all the land around it away. So we're talking about 20,000 new residents. You're talking about a stadium, a lot here. The future has got to be, how are we getting people here by transit, by Metro, not how are we driving everybody in? Traffic's already a mess. Now imagine 8,000 or 10,000 more cars trying to squeeze themselves in there. That's not going to work very well. We got to hear about get people there by transit.
So I'd have to look at, I'm trying to find stadium by stadium in the NFL, some of these urban stadiums, but the average that I'm seeing is 20 to 25,000.
You're looking at suburban stadiums, if that's what the numbers you're looking at. There are stadiums that are able to make it work with less parking.
Right. I'm just saying that's what it returned as the average for the NFL stadiums at this point. But, yeah, I'll take your word for it.
Am I trying to build a stadium or am I trying to build a whole neighborhood? Remember, what we've been build this around is it's an opportunity to build a stadium, but really it's about building out a whole new neighborhood, an entire area. This is 180 acres. So if you were to be building a small city from scratch, would you expect that you'd want to build just parking garages everywhere for people to drive? Or would you expect in a city that you've got your Metro system, that you want to get people in and out by Metro? Those are a lot of the questions we're looking at. You've got a river that is going to change the way you can access this point, this spot, and get into this space. So you've got to really think about this and get it right.
Totally understand that and get that. I feel like they knew when the plans came out, the mayor and the team, though, with 8,000 spots, that, you know, with the $189 million sports facility for the youth and some of the, or whatever that number is, all of the stuff that's involved in this program, I think they have a lot of that stuff, don't they? I mean, when you say it's a neighborhood, not a stadium, that's kind of the idea on their side too, no?
They have talked a lot, but let's talk about the housing. Great example. So the goal is to build the DC law, the bare minimum is 30% of the new homes built would have to be affordable homes because we want this to be a place that everybody can afford to live in and call home, right? There's nothing, absolutely nothing in the deal that requires that affordable housing to be built. I think we need to look at, you know, just across the Potomac River, when Amazon HQ2 is coming in, they actually put in a lot of smart ways that public subsidy got clawed back if the housing didn't get developed, because there could be a lot of ways in which the promises aren't kept in terms of building the housing. That, to me, is one of the details that could change in this deal. Let's make sure we actually write in, when does that housing have to get developed? When does it get delivered? Who are we building for? And if you don't do it like you promised, then we want our public subsidy back. It creates the incentives there, because if this is a partnership, it's got to go both ways, because right now it is a one-way deal.
Councilmember Charles Allen with us here on Grant and Danny. So the questions that you're asking, the things that you're advocating for, et cetera, they're not going to us. They're not going out into the ether. You're probably communicating with economists, independent folks that you see are reviewing these things, the team, the mayor, et cetera. Yep. How are those dialogues going? Is progress being made? And kind of walk us through that in the timeline.
I actually think it is going well. I mean, the commanders have never resisted coming to the table and talking. That's a good sign. When we've highlighted where our questions are, I think the commanders thus far have been really forthcoming. You know, from what I understand from Chairman Mendelson, who's helping lead a lot of this, you know, not as forthcoming from the mayor, but I think the commanders for their part have been sharing a lot of information. Getting the economics are an important part. We do have budget and economists that are taking a look at it to make sure they inform our decisions and how it moves forward. But we're going to have public hearings on July 28th and 29th, I believe, or maybe it's 29th and 30th, but I think there's already over 200 people signed up to testify. It's going to be a long couple of days for those hearings, but that's going to create the public venue and public feedback. We're going to get a lot more people to come in and tell us what they like, what they don't like, what do they want to see changed, what do they want to see protected. And then I would expect that sometime in the fall we move towards a vote.
So when you say it's going well, that's good. For the team, though, they were hoping this would be wrapped up in the summer. And they put out a statement, I believe yesterday, maybe the day before, suggesting that July 15th is still vital here. And you just said you're going to have hearings 2 weeks after that, and you're talking about the fall, which is not the same timeline as theirs. And it sounds like maybe even in the fall that you're hoping to agree to a deal that isn't even on the table yet, right?
There have to be a lot of changes. And so that's going to take a little time, but I would expect you'd see a vote sometime in the fall. But you know,
when you say the fall, is that September? Is that November? Like, what do you mean by that?
My hunch would be it's more in the September, October timeframe, but there's not a set date on that. But listen, if you were the commanders or if you're the mayor, of course you're going to tell everybody, gosh, it's got to happen by this date or everything falls apart. Listen, the commanders have made no secret. They want to be in D.C. And D.C. is coming in full faith, working hard to figure out, is there a deal that can be had here and what changes have to happen? So people need to have a little bit of ice water in their veins here and realize, like, this is a $1 billion industry. We're all talking to each other and working toward what will ultimately be a decision.
So essentially, you're calling their bluff.
What bluff to call? It's not going to happen by July 15th. So it's an artificial deadline that people want to put on us. For what?
But they could go back to Maryland and get the project started if they wanted to.
Really? Governor Moore is already talking about the future of that site and how he finally has a chance to do something different there. That's not going to happen. This is so different than what you saw take place in Virginia, where D.C. worked hard to get Cap 1 back, which should never even gotten to that place. The dynamics are not playing out similarly here. You've got a commander's team that wants to be in D.C. You've got D.C. leaders that are in good faith negotiating and working with the team on that. So I'm not worried about a July 15th date at all. I don't think you should be either.
So that actually, if that's true, then that's a huge development for me and would completely change my tone on the whole thing. You don't think there's a chance that they pivot back to Maryland and say, we can't keep waiting? Because I know from talking to them, they say 2030 opening of the stadium, both for the events that they can host in it and because that is their plan and the commitment they've made to their fans to get out of their current terrible stadium, that they're working back from that date. And maybe that's the bigger priority than being in the city. But your point is, there's nothing to worry about. Don't be frustrated by all of this happening. It's 1,000% going to be D.C., and we're not going to screw it up.
It's a more than a $1 billion investment with a $1 billion industry. So don't pretend there aren't going to be like pressure points that people are going to try to put on folks. Everyone needs to take a breath. Like I said, put a little bit of ice water in your veins and realize this is a big deal. It's a big decision. Everybody's working in good faith, trying to figure out, can that plane be landed? But there's nothing that changes if you want to focus on a 2030 season. There's nothing that changes if the vote takes place July 15th versus September or even October. I think the one piece that I've seen folks throw out is, gosh, we don't want to miss out on the FIFA World Cup 2031 bid. Those bids aren't due until the end of November. So when people try to convince you that there's some magic in July, that's just not true. And I've talked with folks with U.S. Soccer. They're like, as long as you have a decision made by the end of November, so your bid comes in, you're fine. So everyone needs to take a breath here and make sure we get a good deal, because this is a decision we live with for the next 50 to 75 years. It's going to outlast you and me. We've got to make sure we make the right decision for the future of our city, for the future of this part of our city, and make sure that it's the right deal for D.C. taxpayers. Because right now, it's not a good deal. But there is an opportunity to make it a good one, and that's what people should be working toward.
Councilmember, my last one for you along those lines is, you know, how amenable is everybody to getting that good deal, right, that satisfies enough parties? I imagine everyone in different wards might have different things they bring to the table, different asks, which makes sense to me. You're representing, a different neighborhood, a different subsection of people. How close are we to that? How amenable are all the different parties to make those compromises?
You know, I've been talking with a bunch of my colleagues, and I think there's a lot of shared vision and shared goals about the changes that we need to see. That's everything from the economics. I mean, to have the commanders not pay rent or property taxes is just a non-starter, right? So there's economics that happen. Seeing sales tax, it just goes to go back into the stadium rather than all the sales tax that everyone wants to talk about. Why would you not want to see that invested in your schools and public safety and housing? Investing in Metro rather than on parking lots. I'm working with my colleagues. I think there's a lot of shared consensus around how we're going to be able to land this plane and come up with a very solid set of the changes that I think we all need to see.
Did you like the Nats Park deal when it was struck?
I mean, there's parts of it, yes, parts of it, no. But I think that
it's been a smashing success, right?
Well, yeah, but as you and I have talked before, we're talking about a ballpark where you have 200-plus events
Understood.
Per year versus 20 to 25 at a stadium, so they're fundamentally different.
I agree. I just saw the news, though, that it paid off 10 years early, and that, between that, Capital One Arena, and Audi Field.
No. I'm glad you brought that up, because I want to note that.
Yes.
There's nothing about the ballpark why the bonds are being paid off early. that's two-thirds of the ballpark fee that go into that come from taxes around the rest of the city. That's a choice that the city's making to free up our ability to finance this deal. And we have to actually pay a penalty to do it. So paying off the bonds at the ballpark has nothing to do with, hey, isn't it been successful?
Interesting.
Because two-thirds of the money that go into the ballpark fee come from other places all over the city. And we're actually going to have to pay a penalty to pay that off. So we're paying more. That's all about freeing up debt cap space so that we can do financing for another deal.
Gotcha. No, that's good to know. I still would say it's a success sitting in the Navy Yard right now working.
I don't disagree.
And
I don't
we wouldn't have been doing that otherwise, but yeah.
I don't disagree with you. That part's been very successful. But in terms of paying off the bonds early, that's not a link you can make around the success around the ballpark. Creating a venue that has more than 200 events per year, big major events, that drives success. That's why you heard me early on arguing for the arena, locking down the Nats to get a renewed lease. But a football stadium with 20 to 25 events is a fundamentally different thing than something that happens all year long.
Yeah, we've talked about that many, many times. All right, last one. You see why we like having Charles Allen on? Answers every question we've got for him, goes back and forth with us.
You're going to ask me who we should draft first with the Nats?
No, but I would like to ask you.
Love your input there, actually.
You could come on Bustin' Loose Baseball with me and Toby Altizer.
Tate Anderson has got to be your number one pick. Like, that's just a no-brainer.
I'm a Tate Anderson guy. My co-host wants Ethan Holliday. He wants to have the regional rivalry with the Orioles. Here's my question. Mark Seagraves floated this today on our station. He said, when RFK was first built, it was built by the federal government. Plan B could be an end around of the D.C. government and going to the federal government. Your reaction to that?
I think what you're going to see is, you know, kind of scare tactics like that, trying to create pressure campaigns, right? I mean, you could say that about just about every single thing in D.C. right now, that somehow Donald Trump and a federal government wants to take over this, that, or the other. The reality on the ground is the commanders are at the table. The city is at the table. People are talking. People are working. So I don't lose a wink of sleep over the fact that people are in good faith trying to figure out what has to change. What has to change to make this a better deal and a fair deal for D.C. and D.C. taxpayers? Can we get there? Can we land the plane? There's a lot of cool heads in the room. Let's not get too distracted by the higher temperatures that might be somewhere else.
Charles Allen, boys and girls, you're my guy. I just need you to get this done and not screw this up for me. Let's have a football stadium. D.C., nation's capital, we should have a football stadium. Let's do it. Let's do this thing together.
Well, you're going to tell, and I'm sure you're telling the commanders as well, that why would they not move their headquarters in D.C.? If they say this is their spiritual home, if they say this is the place they want to be, why are they so afraid to put their headquarters here? They'd be the only franchise in D.C., not headquartered in D.C. Tell me how that makes any sense.
I will pass that along to them when I talk to them tomorrow.
There you go.
All right? Both sides of this. We're doing this, Charles.
Thank you, sir.
We're going to get this deal done on this radio show one way or the other. We're bringing everybody
one
to the table.
One way or the other. All right. Have fun with the bananas tonight.
Appreciate
See
you,
man. Take care. There's Charles Allen on Grant and Danny. Always like having him on the program. He answers everything.
Yes, he does.
You know, he's great to have on, so we appreciate him.